This is the Green Majority, Canada's longest running environmental news hour. Your grandmother is claiming her power, and she has cursed me personally.
We have no living grandmothers.
I'm talking to the listener.
I don't have any either. Oh, that is sad. We have no grandmas between the three of us. My grandma would literally never have cursed anyone. She was so nice. Though, oh my God, I had a great grandmother, or maybe even a great great grandmother. Anyway, I only learned this when I was going down south recently in the States. My mom was like, "Did you know your grandma so and so was a white witch?" Or she used to call herself that. And I was like,
"A white witch.
White as in good, not white as in right. racist."
Okay, you need to claim your power.
Yeah. I do. Oh my God, the daughters of the white witches, they did not burn.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, or your local community radio station, your podcast application, Harbinger Media Network. My name is David Franklin Irwin Hostetter. I am with Stefan Christian Irwin Hostetter.
That's true.
As well as Lauren Elizabeth Corlatour.
I was going to say, we could pretend I'm not here, and I could just be a disembodied voice.
And Lauren is in Ottawa, where the Parliament building is being renovated, which I did not realize. I was in Ottawa, and I went to the Parliament buildings, and I realized that they are sitting in a tacky theater for all their little public debates. They moved the green chairs into this newfangled what used to be a courtyard, put a roof over it, and then erected these hideous steel, dark gray, fake tree-like things. And then so the old Parliament has been supplanted into a new place, and it is it's a horror show.
And it's going to be like that for like 10 years. Like, it's like a huge, long...
A woman who was running tours across the street was like, "You need to check out the big hole. There's special stairs you can walk up to look into the big hole." This thing was very unimpressive as a large hole. I'm just like, that's just a hole.
But like, was it the biggest hole you've seen?
I've seen larger.
All right.
Oh my God. My hometown, London, Ontario, we once had a big sinkhole, and it was like a hole. Like, if you think about like a, I don't know, 4-6 lane road intersection where it was like 4 lanes this way, 4 lanes that way, etc. Anyway, it was the whole size of the intersection. It was like a really big deal.
Take that, Ottawa. London's got a better hole than you do.
Yeah, we had a better hole. And London doesn't have much to speak of at all, really.
And Stefan will be interviewing Pullback podcast hosts about their series that they did with La Hub.
Exactly. It's Kyla Hewson and Kristen Pugh. If you're looking to get some quick pieces of information about the number one questions that come to the Climate Organizing Hub from organizers across Canada, including interviews with organizers across Canada about their experiences, that's what this series will do. Other thing I should note is that if you're listening to this on the radio show live, they are doing a live event later this evening on Friday that you can check out if you go to Lub's website.
I'm excited for the podcast series myself because not only are the folks at Pullback great, but Lub is really fantastic. If you're a listener and you are involved in climate justice or grassroots work in any capacity, definitely go check out Lub or the Climate Justice Hub. If you're interested and you're looking for resources, they do really fantastic work. Their team is very cool.
I literally opened the interview with me saying that they had an idea I wish I had.
Stefan does not like to be defeated.
Well, I mean, I should say very quickly, sorry, as a quick second note, I discover in the interview that we were the inspiration for it. I asked the first question.
Oh, here we go. Now he's claiming.
I'm not claiming. You can listen to the
interview.
It's coming
for that
later.
Which he failed to do himself.
It's coming and
even
in
conceive.
The interview.
Even conceived to do himself.
There is a good chance they were telling us that to stroke our ego, in which case I'll take it. I need it. My self-esteem is extremely fragile, hanging on by a thread. I'll take whatever I can get.
I'll let listeners listen to the interview and you can decide. It's in the interview, though.
Stefan's just looking for a dub. He needs a dub. he's on the street corners asking for dubs.
It's desperate, Dave. It's desperate.
We're going to move into some climate news here. So it's been calculated that just the first 2 months, it's been 6 months total, but just the first 2 months of Israel's assault on Gaza created more greenhouse gas emissions than over 20 of the most climate vulnerable nations create in an entire year. Global militaries produce 5.5% of global emissions, which is more than aviation and shipping combined, which I was actually surprised by.
Yeah.
the policy analyst, a policy analyst from Al-Shabaka, Zina Aiga, is quoted in Mother Jones as saying, "The catastrophic aerial attack on Gaza will not fade when a ceasefire comes. The military detritus will continue to live in the soil, the earth, the sea, and the bodies of the Palestinians living in Gaza, just as it does in other post-war contexts, such as Iraq." And militaries, I guess, they're actually, it's a volunteer basis for reporting emissions, militaries.
There are so many overlaps between the military industrial complex and ways in which we're destroying the earth. But, I mean, it feels almost, I think part of the reason why it's hard to talk about it is that it feels so secondary to the horrendous destruction of human life to then be like, but the emissions are also bad. Like, that feels like a hard transition to make. And yet the fact that you can have these huge emissions coming from these institutions that basically cannot, you know, are nearly impossible to rein in because they have all the weapons, that are not even really being included in our calculations for emission reduction. You know, like, they're not even necessarily being included because it's not happening in any country. It's happening in the flights they're taking, that they don't want to tell you what they're doing, and all of the ways that we can't calculate these things. Like, removing power from the military, as noted here with 5.5%, which again is a hopeful amount that we don't know for sure because they don't have to report all the things they're doing, is 100% required for a world that takes life more generally seriously.
The emissions aren't the main reason that anybody is opposed to attacks on Gaza right now, obviously. But I think that's sort of the thing, is that it's like, it's there's been an odd, and this is like a question, this is just musing, this isn't a fully formed thought, but like the disconnect or lack of cohesion between anti-war movements of the last, I don't know, 20 years, basically, ever since kind of like the anti-globalization movement really started to collapse in the early 2000s. Yeah, there's been a disconnect between sort of like anti-war, I guess maybe even pro-pacifism, movements within progressive and leftist spaces, and that includes sort of how they interact with climate, but just other progressive and leftist actors in general. And I would sort of like love to, like, obviously we don't have to do it today, but like, I think I need to spend some more time thinking about where that comes from, because when I think oftentimes when we think of like a typical like anti-war activist, they're white, they're at this point, they're middle-aged, they're Gen X, if not somebody in more of the boomer demographic. And it is sort of interesting that despite having grown up largely millennials, we came of age in an era of like wartime for all intents and purposes with the Iraq War. It is interesting that this isn't sort of a rallying cry that we have taken up a little bit more, and that folks who do definitely identify as like, I would say, anti-imperialist, and folks who do want to expressly take a decolonial approach to their work, that this hasn't sort of been something we've focused on more. And maybe that's because people don't want to necessarily take their, to sort of couch the decolonization anti-imperialist work in sort of the rhetoric of carbon reductions, and make the sort of like moral and ethical imperative to act in sort of solidarity with folks in the global south. Like, you don't want to burden it with the emissions reduction aspect of it. But anyway, yeah, there are definitely people that have thought more comprehensively and have more coherent thoughts to express around this. But it's just sort of something that's been coming up for me lately. It's like, huh, there is a disconnect. Why does that exist?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it might be that, you know, our age, we're just a little too young for the Iraq War. And so, like, we sort of grew up in the 2010s to 2020s, which, you know, still had, you know, war obviously happening over all over the place, but didn't really have that sort of galvanizing experience. But I think you're right. I mean, one of the big questions and one of the big ways that I think we have to reckon with militarism is the way it enforces colonialism. And you cannot be anti-colonial and not be anti-militarism, right? Like, those things are hand in hand in the ways that they, you know, sow destruction on the earth. And I think that if we are going to be serious about our solidarity with, you know, countries in the global south and those that are dealing with you know, the over militarization of the, especially United States and the, in but, you know, anyone really, you have to also bring that anti-military stance to it. And it's, maybe it just feels harder to tackle that, especially in the States, I imagine, but it's, they go hand in hand. You have to. Which I think segues really well into the next story.
New York has deployed the National Guard to the city's subway system. Police have been searching people's bags for years, but now 750 soldiers are conducting bag searches on the New York City subway.
I cannot fathom how a Democratic governor, and it just goes to show you how these words don't mean anything, all depends on where you are, but that a Democratic governor would decide to send in the military to check bags on the subway. If there is a way to prevent me from using the subway, putting 750 people with armed machine guns into it is a pretty good way to prevent people from feeling safe on the subway. And it's, you know, again, it's based off this sort of drummed up fear that was created by the media, and you know, despite violent crime going down in New York in the year, they've still managed to decide that this is the thing they care about more than anything. And despite the fact that the shooting that happened like a week and a half ago happened in a subway that is literally embedded inside a police station, does not seem to have any impact. And the thing I saw that most drove this home for me was that if you're a party that is trying to convince people that you're really worried about fascism from the other side, maybe don't make it feel like fascism now. You know, like maybe don't set up the systems to normalize the use of the National Guard to check people's bags as they enter the subway. Like, I just can't fathom the idea of them deciding they should deploy the National Guard in places where they are dealing with, you know, to every Uber that exists in it. It's just like, it's so, so ridiculous. And so, in my mind, sets the table for a much darker, darker time in a way that, like, I mean, what are you supposed to do? When Trump decides to put in the National Guard into the subway for some other reason, and then the Democrats try to claim, you know, that this is bad. I mean, you've lost the argument. You've handed it to them. And this is terrifying.
No, absolutely. It's like the image that it evokes is like something from, I don't know, like Escape from New York or like a Batman movie or something like that, where like you said, like, I think like rates of violence or violent crime have gone down. I think when you get instances like this, this is like an extremely bad faith reading on my part, but like, is it an attempt to protect people, or is it an attempt just to stoke fear and increased reliance on militarism and on police forces? And I think at the end of the day, that's kind of what it is. It's in order to create a culture of fear and reliance, where it otherwise wouldn't exist or need to exist. It's also amazing to me, and keep in mind, I'm saying this as somebody who, like, I have not gone to the New York Times and read their take on this. It's amazing that the citizens of New York, for all of their sort of like, I don't know, we're rough and tumble, we're scrappy, we handle, like, you know what I mean? Like, they have this kind of like image of themselves as being able to like handle their own stuff, that like anybody would be down for this. The fact that people aren't like, I don't know, maybe not rioting in the streets because clearly the National Guard's been called in, but the fact that there isn't like a huge uproar, and that this wasn't something that was shut down within like 24 hours and they didn't immediately walk it back as like, oh, sorry, you're right, bad idea, is kind of bananas.
A new report from the Alberta Utilities Commission is refuting Alberta Premier Danielle Smith's contention that renewables pose a threat to the province's farmland. The report says that even if all renewable development happens on Alberta's best land, they will still only have lost 1% of that land by 2041. Bob Weber reports for the Energy Mix, quote, Danielle Smith's government's latest restrictions could cost it 42 new projects totaling $11 billion Canadian dollars in investment and 3.6 gigawatts of new generating capacity.
Yeah, so this is just a follow-up from the story we've been covering the last couple weeks with the weighing in from the Alberta Utilities Commission, basically saying that the decision that Smith made is as political as everyone thought it was. And, I mean, we'll see if it has an impact and sways her to step back a little bit. I'm not holding my breath, to be honest, but 1% of the land by 2041 is not a threat to your farmland or anything, or your pristine views, as they mentioned in the act itself or in the decision itself. I mean, it just goes to show just how political it is and just how harmful it will be to Albertans.
I wish, and I know they are, it's not like people aren't trying to message this way, but like, I wish the liberals, I wish progressive or even like centrist media were doing a better job of telling this story and telling it, like looking, taking it at face value and saying like, this is not a business friendly government. And when they try to tell you that the actions they're taking are in support of business, are in support of the economy and of everyday Albertans, like that is a lie. And that is a lie because this demonstrates that it's BS. These provisions being put in place by Premier Smith aren't in any way about protecting people and aren't in any way about protecting the business interests of Alberta. It's about propping up the oil and gas industry in order to increase her personal and her personal friends' coffers. It's crony capitalism at its most obvious. And the fact that that's not being like screamed from the rooftops by any, like, I don't know, unbiased media source and by anyone in the political opposition is wild to me. I know we're running out of time, but just like the only thing that I sort of like tangentially, because I always just want to like hammer on ridiculous conservative politicians here, like we got in all of the sort of carbon tax craziness over the last couple of weeks in so-called Canada, we got Polyev just today when we record, people know we record on Wednesdays, putting in place he wants to put forward a non-confidence vote for Trudeau around the carbon tax. And he's been hosting these like Axe the Tax rallies all across the country, and they're being wildly well attended and it's really popular. And I just don't understand how people aren't seeing through this. But like, I get why people aren't seeing through this, because they're being fed really effective messaging on the part of conservatives. And it's just incredibly depressing that the liberals are sleepwalking to a loss here in 18 months, in 16 months or whatever. I'm grumpy about it.
Very fair. And if I leave us with one thought, if the liberals are going down, which they're definitely gonna go down, one thing they have to get done is the Status for All Act they've promised for multiple years. Like, get it done in enough time that you can actually get started on it so Polyev can't get it back. Like, the work that Migrant Justice Alliance has been doing on this, they just had a rally last week here in the city, and it's some of the most important work that we can get done. And they've dragged their feet on it, and everyone knows they're going down. So, like, do one good thing before you go down, and do right by these people. They deserve it.
That's actually something we should do within the next few weeks, because it's getting to be near the end of March now. The House is going to rise in just a couple months. There really isn't that much time left from a legislative standpoint. We should look at all of the good policy that's currently sitting on the table, potentially will die there. Because in addition to the Status for All legislation, there's a number of other bills that are in or regulations that are in various stages of stagnation. And they could be using this time effectively. They could be passing so much. And I understand, yes, that PharmaCare for All went through a couple weeks ago in a really exciting way, and they're going to try to stand on that in the election. But like, there's more work that needs to be done, and they have to do it like now. If anybody's going to see any benefit from it, and B, if they want to use it, if they want to try to campaign on it at all. It's anyway. I don't work in politics. I'm not on the Hill, but it's incredibly frustrating to watch this wind down the way it is.
And we're going to go to a smooth music break and return with Stefan interviewing the hosts of the Pullback podcast about their experience speaking with people running La Hub.
And other climate justice organizers across the country.
Introducing Climate Organizing Shorts, a series of conversations to help inspire ideas for fostering change in your community.
That's genuinely what we're trying to do, is build power together as average people to hold decision makers accountable and get the basic things we all need.
Witnessing work is really big in a lot of Indigenous cultures.
You do not have to be a super serious revolutionary.
It's okay to make mistakes.
The joys of it are so amplified when you're in community with others, and it's easier to shoulder when you're standing side by side with others and not alone.
You can't build a foundation for a movement that's going to last over the long haul that is fragmented.
I sleep well at night. I don't have a lot of anxiety about the future because I know I'm doing something really meaningful.
Pick a fight with somebody. You're a climate organizer now.
Find Climate Organizing Shorts wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome back to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, or perhaps on one of our greatly appreciated radio syndicates across the country, or maybe found us on the podcast, which can be found anywhere podcasts can be found, including now with the Harbinger Media Network. And as previewed earlier on the show, we are excited to welcome two fellow Harbingers, which is The last time I was interviewing a fellow Harbinger Knight, we discussed how to say that. And at least Jeremy from Big Shiny Takes thinks Harbingers straight up is the way to go. So
No. Harbinginians.
Ooh, I didn't even know that was an option. It could be like Virginia.
I like the idea that we're a Harbinger podcast, you know, like it's a collective noun.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, we're a Harbinger of podcasts where it's like a murder of crows. I like that.
Exactly.
Okay. But we're joined by Kyle Hewson and Kristen Pugh, hosts of the Pullback podcast, who've been on the show a couple times now and are back with an idea, a short series that I wish we did. And so I'm going to try to extract as much information out of you to pretend that we did it so that I can at least get some of the glory back. So this idea is a great one. You are interviewing folks from which is a fantastic climate organization. We've interviewed Sarah on the show back last year. So you can go and check that if you want to see that. About the most common questions that they get from climate activists. Is that like a good description?
Yeah, it's a great description.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Kyla, you talk.
Yeah. That's amazing. The only difference I would add is that it's not just the people from Le Hub that we're talking to, but they've put us in connection with a ton of different activists from different organizations, because part of Le Hub's mandate is to connect different organizations and to give them steps on how to build their own movements. And so a lot of the people that we're talking to are actually from different spaces in the climate organizing universe, and they all have different takes on, I mean, we do talk to Le Hub as well, but they all have amazing different takes on the many different topics that Le Hub often gets questioned about.
Yeah, and we tried to do a good cross-section geographically as well as like to get a lot of different sort of experience and background sort of perspective. So I think it's a really good, like you get a really good cross-section of what the climate movement is like in Canada, even for, I mean, I guess listeners of your show probably are already well-versed, but for somebody that is a new initiate, it'd be a sort of a good introduction as well.
Let's start with the question that, again, I wish I had this idea, and so I'm curious how you had this idea. What inspired you to think to make this short series?
Your podcast. We were listening to the episode that you did with Sarah.
So full circle.
It was you all along. Kristen reached out to Le Hub to ask them if she could volunteer, and they were like, oh, we see that you do a podcast. Would you like to do one for us? And Kristen and Sarah worked together to kind of brainchild this into being, and I was the guy in the chair.
I did not, listeners, I didn't know that was the answer. I should be honest. I feel like it could sound like I set that one up, but I did not know that was the answer. So I will take the win where I can get it, though. So can you tell me, walk me through the 9 episodes. What were the questions that you asked?
Yeah, sure. So for each episode, we asked different questions, but it's essentially sort of, we were asking about the experience of a climate organizer who is experienced in a particular thing. So I'll give you an example. Our first episode that we're going to be releasing on March 22nd is about deep canvassing. And we talked to Montana Burgess of Neighbors United, who's basically piloted like the first climate deep canvassing campaign, I think in North America. And so we talked to her all about that, got her experience to sort of explain what deep canvassing is, why it matters, and also sort of like how somebody that might be thinking about a deep canvassing campaign could get started. So that's a good example of sort of the flow of the episodes. But we also talked about a really wide range of different things. So de-escalation, how do you do that during protests, was another topic we talked about. We've also talked about things like disability, accessibility, creating an accessible movement, how the climate movement can approach Indigenous solidarity. So there's a lot of different topics in there that are all, I think, ones that people who are either already organizing or maybe somebody who's thinking about starting a climate group in their community that would be sort of helpful to move forward.
Cool. Yeah, I love that because it's so practical. So much out there that is theoretical or that is talks about the, you know, ideas behind why we do what we do, and not nearly as much content is made to be like, no, here's how you do this thing. Like, you want to know how to make your meeting more accessible? These 5 things, you should do them. And at least that are sort of aimed at new groups starting up. you sort of get those types of conversations, like maybe from like these larger NGO type spaces where it's like, oh, here's the five tips you can do that, and it becomes sort of a LinkedIn post, but it's not, doesn't really have the practicality so often of like, you need to do these things, or you're trying to figure out how to start something, or, you know, or make sure that something goes well, do this. Like, that practicality is really key.
Yeah. And I think our episode about disability justice in climate spaces was really good for that, for really bringing together the idea of why it's important and how smaller groups especially can forget or leave behind these sort of ideas, because we're all, the climate movement has a lot to do, right? Like, we're busy. We've got a lot going on. And it feels like these grand ideals that we're reaching for are so elevated and high that it's hard to focus on the small things, but you can't get to the top without taking those baby little ladder steps, right? And a big part of that is building a really strong foundation in your movement. And our episode on Indigenous solidarity and especially disability justice were, I found, really enlightening in the idea that people just need to even stop to think about it. A lot of people think, oh, we don't have time for that. We're too small. We don't have the space or the capacity. But you do. And it's actually easier than you think.
Yeah. And I think that was a really big point of the Indigenous solidarity episode, that, you know, sometimes people can be paralyzed by the fear of making a mistake. And sometimes you just have to get in there and try. And the effort is what matters. And that was also something we got from, we did a great episode on divestment with Jenna Jandal, who has basically single-handedly, no, she did it with other people, but kicked RBC off campus at her university. And she was really inspiring, I thought, because she had started from zero. She just picked a fight with RBC on campus. And so it really shows that, like, anybody really can get involved. And it's not as overwhelming as you might think.
Yeah, starting small is really important. And a lot of people, especially in the climate space or even outside of it, you know, everybody's feeling overwhelmed, everybody's tired, but it doesn't need to be as big as starting a banner drop with 40 people on a bridge downtown. You know, like, it can be as small as, I mean, just email your MP, guys. We talk about more than that. We are talking to people in the climate organizing space specifically who have already kind of started the work, but there is also a lot for listeners who are not there yet and are ready to get going. So I think we did a pretty good job of covering a breadth of experience, from very beginner to people who maybe are already in the space and just want, you know, some more content to listen to spark your imagination.
And imagination sparking is important. And so I'm curious, you've done a decent number of these episodes, a couple more to go, but is there anything that you've learned so far that you're like, oh, wow, this thing people should know about?
I found the de-escalation episode very fun, in that de-escalation for me is kind of scary because I'm just a little girl. and it's hard to kind of go to a space where you might have to be in confrontation with somebody. And so I think a lot of people stay away from climate protests because of that. But what we learned from Robbie in our de-escalation episode, who's a regular guest on our own show, Pullback, the number one thing that he told us to do, and I think I'm taking this not just for the climate movement, but in, like, on board for my own personal life, is just be calm. Like, show what you want to receive. If you want the other person to calm down, be calm yourself, right? And it really is that easy. And the other thing is, you know, everybody wants something. If you know what the other person wants, it's pretty easy to kind of level with them and get to that space. And also, most people are decent. And so, you know, if people do want to throw fists or whatever, it's not your job as a climate organizer to stop that. It's your job to keep other people safe. And I really appreciated that. I found he talked about marshalling at climate protests a lot. And I kind of want to be a marshal now. He really made it sound like a ton of fun, which is wild because de-escalation sounds so scary. But he made a really good point that, like, if you're just having a good time, like, counter-protesters will often just go home. Kristen, what's your favorite thing that you learned?
Oh, I mean, I learned so many things, but I think the episode on disability justice with Daniel Serra, it just had so many practical tips that I hadn't thought about, and including that the most important thing you can do for accessibility at an actual protest is, like, information, which seems really obvious. But if you just provide information about what the barriers might potentially be, people can make choices for themselves. And it's just such a simple thing. Even organizations with not a lot of resources can take that step at the very least, right? Can't always make sure that like there's every single, like you can't always pay for sign language interpreters and things like that. You can always provide the information about like what's going to be happening, when the end time's going to be, where the bathrooms are going to be. Everybody wants to know that. That's such a good piece of advice.
And the transparency makes people feel safer coming forward with their access needs, right? They're like, this is a space that might actually listen to me if I come up and I say that I need this access need. And so just providing information makes it easier for people to tell you what you might need to do if you aren't thinking about it.
So often when groups, new groups, and I've experienced this myself, come into play, you find yourself in this weird balance of you don't have any resources. So you feel like you can't do a lot of things, but then you feel an urgency to do stuff. So you end up doing as much as you can, which means that you don't actually give yourself the time to do the pre-planning. Like all of what you're describing there is just more work, right? It's just more time. It's nothing else, right? Like to tell people where the bathrooms are is not more money. It is literally just doing the work beforehand to think it through and be like, look at a map and be like, okay, well, here's the closest accessible washrooms to where we're going to do this thing, starting a month out instead of immediately. And I think that like we have this weird challenge, and I think this is more general to the climate movement and to our lives currently, which is that we have this drive and need to take action as fast as possible. And so we do that in a way that ends up being a bit more scattershot. Like if we just accepted that, okay, I'm going to do this rally, but I'm going to do this rally in an extra month later, and to give myself just a ton of time to be able to do these other pieces, you'll end up with a more effective rally, maybe not at the exact moment you thought you wanted or whatever, or you had to start thinking about it earlier than you expected, but you can make up for a lack of resources with an investment of giving yourself the space and time and slowing yourself down. Like it's amazing how much more you can do when you slow yourself down.
That was actually 100%. One of my favorite points that was made by Janelle Lapointe in our Indigenous Solidarity episodes, which is that the climate movement has this sense of urgency, which is fair. I mean, we're in a but the climate is not going to be doing great for a long time. And we really owe it to ourselves to slow down. We owe it to ourselves and to the people that come after us to not be in a constant state of panic. And like, yes, it's urgent, fine, but it's not going anywhere. So everyone take a deep breath. And she really lent on her own Indigenous teachings to kind of talk about how you need to think about things in the long run. And if you're packing a bag for a trip, in a night is the analogy she used that was wonderful, then it feels awful. You're in a hurry and it feels rushed and you're going to forget stuff. You're going to forget stuff and you're going to have a bad time. So everyone just needs to breathe to like, this is going to take a lifetime and that's okay, right? I love this work. And sometimes it can be kind of depressing, but one of the points that came up again and again and again in every single episode is everybody who's in this space and who's making an effort to make our world better feels like they have purpose and like they have something to be working towards. And I really appreciated that. And yeah, the point that you made is exactly right. Like the sense of urgency that we have that makes us kind of trip over our own feet to get to something. But why, right? Like it's, there's just going to be another thing after that. So everyone breathe.
Yeah. And I think, like, as you mentioned, Kyla, this theme came up in a couple of different episodes. And I really liked in Daniel Sarah's episode on disability justice, the point that, like, if you do take that extra time and effort to make sure that the movement is inclusive, it actually makes for a much stronger movement in the long run because people can participate in the ways that they can. And because it's not a sprint, you need people to really be engaged in the best way that they can to contribute. So it's more effective also, in addition to feeling better.
That's something I think that is really hard to unlearn, I think, for those of us who are steeped not only in the urgency of the feeling of the moment, but also the urgency that is created by our sort of capitalist system to say produce, 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 you know? And so the need to undo both of those things at the same time, because like one really feeds the other. You have this deep feeling of needing to produce because of sort of the internalized capitalism in the world we live in. And then you're told that there's like a very scary thing coming very soon. And you're like, ah, I do need to do a bunch of stuff because have you seen that? But, you know, as we've seen, the path towards change doesn't come from 150 very quickly thrown together rallies. Like that's not a successful path towards change. And so we have to find other ways, right?
Well, and one of my favorite things that we talked about with Montana Burgess in the Deep Canvassing episode is that the most, I think what I learned from that is one of the most effective ways to create change, especially at the local level, which is where change needs to be made. You can't change everything all at once. Is just to have conversations with people that last more than 5 minutes where you're not trying to sell them something, right? Like you're going to go door knocking. Be ready to ask curious questions and listen to people as they talk about their, like, as they talk about these things that maybe they've just heard sound bites for, but they haven't actually had a chance to work through because we're all so busy living in our capitalist nightmare that nobody has time to sit down and actually think about the things that Pierre Polyev or whoever is saying. And so they'll have a chance on the door with these deep canvassers to maybe think aloud for the first time and be like, wait a second, I don't actually agree with that. And conversations like that take time and they're slow, but they're really worth it because once you get somebody on side, that's somebody else in your movement. It's like a zombie apocalypse, right? Like the more people you can get in your horde.
Are we the zombies in this analogy?
Kristen, there's zombies in every analogy that I want to make. You're only lucky that I don't do it as often as I want.
Although I do like the idea that we are the zombies. Because that gave us a way better chance, I think, honestly. Like, in every zombie movie, the zombies are the ones that are slowly taking over versus the opposite, right? So, like, exactly. If we're the zombies, that's great. Great news for us.
Yeah, and it's just one little bite. It's one little bite, and then you infect the person, and then they're on your side. It's that easy. Just be a zombie.
They're also slow. The metaphor really works. But I do love that point about deep canvassing and sort of the need to actually just have these longer conversations, because so often those are the places where real change can happen, and some of the super interesting work around deep canvassing is being done. So the other thing that I really wanted to get to in this conversation, which is a slight deviation, but I think it's valuable, is about the role of what we do collectively and the role that there is for this type of media in the world. Like what's so interesting is that you reached out to Lub and they were like, oh, you have this skill of being a podcaster. Do you want to be a podcaster for us in this cool way? And like, that's so much more useful than just, hey, do you want to like lick stamps, which is like half of volunteering so often, right? Like so much of a challenge that you see is how to actually effectively use volunteers and how effectively to use their skills that they like doing. And so the ways that this sort of came to be, I think, goes to begin to think about how the importance of us creating this infrastructure for the movement. And I don't see it just as, you know, obviously our two shows, which, again, as we said before air, are not news shows. Like, none of us are doing combative interviews. Like, we're not doing deep investigative work. You know, we're communicators, I think is more probably accurate. And so I'm curious how you see your role within the climate movement. Like, how do you think about what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. I think for me, at least, and hopefully for Kyla as well, you know, we've spent so much time talking not just about climate issues, but like also social justice issues is really important to pull back the podcast. So I think we kind of see our role as like public educators, people who are going to talk about topics that deserve a little bit more attention, but in a way that's not, hopefully, we try, hopefully not dry and hopefully not too depressing. So for me, that's kind of the value add that we have. And we've brought that through Pullback. But I think really in this, like in climate organizing shorts, I think it really comes through. The trailer Kyla put together is so optimistic, but it's accurate. It's accurate. All the conversations end on a good note. What do you think, Kyla?
What I find really valuable in the work that not only Kristen and I, but everyone on the Harbinger Media Network, and Stefan, you and your team specifically as well, is to find joy in the climate movement. Because I think, and I don't think this is entirely our fault, I think a lot of this is coming from the right and from big oil, kind of building these fake climate organizations that are like, oh, but it's so much work, and oh, it takes so much personal sacrifice, and to make change happen, you know, it's going to be difficult and hard, and do we even want to try? And it's wrong. And I think that there's so much space for joy. And something that I've learned by doing like our social justice podcast is that by thinking these things through in a way that isn't objective, in the way that news kind of forces themselves to be, which I take issue with, but by just being honest about how, like, yeah, it's hard, but also there's so much joy to be found. I was on a hike yesterday, and somebody asked me, like, what are the three things you would change in Vancouver if you could snap your fingers and change something overnight? And I was like, oh, the first thing I would do is I would take all of the cars off the road, right? And then I would change all of the trees to fruit-bearing trees. And, like, yes, those things sound hard, like, but, like, just imagine the possibilities of how fun it is. Like, you don't need to think about, like, how much work it's going to be. That can come later, right? It's all about the idea of imagining a better world, which I think that Green Majority does a really good job of. And I think a lot of really, like, a lot of the leftist organizations on Harbinger do a really good job of just painting a picture of, like, what if things were better? what if things were better? And, like, yeah, it'll be hard, but you know what else is hard? Capitalism and the system that we live in now. It's already hard. Why not be hard in a way that's making things better? And so I think of ourselves as kind of an education podcast in that we do take information and, you know, regurgitate it, but in a way that I think Kristen, especially because she has like a PhD in social like sciences, is so eloquent at doing. And I really appreciate the work that we're all kind of doing here in Canada in this space that we're creating. And something that the Climate Justice Hub is doing really well is taking people like Kristen and I, recognizing our skills and coming up with really fun ways that we can build this movement together. And they've got this really cool wiki that they're putting together. They've got so many cool projects on the go. And it just makes me really excited to continue working with all of the different organizations in Canada that are starting to branch out. Like, I think the pandemic has given people a lot of space to kind of rethink how we approach the work that we do. And you can see it in even organizations like, you know, the David Suzuki Foundation, or I don't know, there's big ones that are out in the East Coast, I'm sure. The way they're approaching their volunteers and the work they're doing to try and engage the public more, because we can't do this alone. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think another role that we can play is being sort of connectors, right? Because certainly that's something that I get from your podcast a lot. You know, when you folks do interviews, it's oftentimes with like a group that maybe I'd heard of, but I wasn't sure that they were doing a particular thing, or in many cases, it's sort of very new to me. And hopefully people get the same experience from our podcast, but it's a good way to show that there is actually a lot of momentum happening on a lot of fronts. You know, the world is bad, but also there's lots of people that are working very hard and making a lot of progress to make it better. And I think that, like, in addition to Kyla's point that we can imagine these sort of like alternative worlds, the idea that there's already people that are making an active difference and hearing their experiences, I think is really valuable and helps us to all sort of like become a little bit like less nihilistic, maybe, I hope.
We all feel a little less alone, and it makes it easier for people to think about what they can do, right? Like, everyone has a skill. I anybody listening to this, you have a skill. You do. I know you do. And you know you do. And there is a way to use it for good, even if it doesn't seem like there is. Like, maybe you're a really good knitter. Guess what? Everybody needs pussy hats. I don't know if you can use that, but enjoy.
I'll find out. We'll find out. If I get a strongly worded message from the CRTC, I'll know I know I can't. I do think that there are so many roles. And this is like, I think, maybe what is some of the more interesting ways I've heard people talk about thinking about the movement is this idea of like finding, you know, how do you find your place in it? And it's about like finding your skill set and then finding a way to plug it in, because that is such a necessary part of A, maintaining your own existence, right? Like if you're a volunteer and you want to get in part of the movement, and then the only thing you're offered is licking postage stamps, for example, that's not a unique skill you get to use, right? Like you're not finding your own unique way into the movement. It's like, oh, okay, I'm just another person. And like the need for that kind of stuff exists, and I'm not trying to say it's not real, but there's more longevity in finding something that uses your own personal skills, that where you can feel like I am the one who needs to do this because I have XYZ thing, you know, and that can be as simple as like, I am good at taking photographs, so I should go to, you know, marches with my iPhone or whatever and take photos. And like, that's a value add, right? Like huge value add, right? Like as someone who's done many events, the random person who's good at social media who comes to your event is your favorite person because they do so much work for you, right? Like, it's like, oh, great. They're just going to do three great photos that I can then post later. And that's really helpful. And it helps grow the movement, right?
And I think people really downplay their own skill sets when it comes to stuff like that. Cause like, oh, anybody can take a photo with an iPhone, but you know what? Nobody is. So please be the person doing it. You are so valuable. And it does sound easy, but please, just because it sounds easy, great. It's easy for you. Please do it. And I think the work that you're doing, Steph, is like connecting all of the dots for people where, okay, you talk to a different organization, you know, every week. And one of the number one things that people can do to get involved is to just pick a cause, right? Like there are so many things to worry about that it can become overwhelming. It's kind of like when you go to the grocery store and you're looking at the shelf and there's like 1,200 different peanut butters and you're like, oh my goodness, how do I choose?
All owned by BlackRock fundamentally.
Yeah. So you find the one peanut butter or two that aren't owned by BlackRock, and then you figure out how your skill set can maybe help out. And I think that the number one thing you can do is pick a cause. And something that we found in all of the interviews that we were doing is that most of the causes that you're going to pick are connected. So if you pick one, you really are working on everything all at once. Climate change connects to everything. So if you are a women's rights activist and you get into the women's rights space, well, guess what? Like improving life for women around the world or locally, there's climate stuff that will be fixed by that.
I also just wanted to give a brief shout out to the people with boring skills out there. Those skills really matter. Like, even if what you're good at is like balancing financial books, writing email, you know, it doesn't have to be a super sexy skill that you have. Especially the boring ones are often the most needed. So accountants, get in there.
I cannot tell you how tedious it is to edit audio.
No group is ever for lacking of a want of a good note taker. If you can just record what people are saying, you will be the most useful person in any organization, because it will save you from doing the same thing every 3 months, because you can go back and be like, no, look, we had this discussion and we did these things. Those, and again, that goes back, I guess, a little bit to this idea of like those infrastructure pieces, both within small movements and then sort of within the larger movements, are the things that are the bedrock of social change. Like, you are not going, people see social change as the sort of big high level things, like the big marches and yada yada, but like all of those are built brick by brick by these much, much more boring skills, like by the good note taker, by the good facilitator, by the person who's willing to take an hour out of their day to talk to someone on their doorstep. Like, those things are the bricks that build up. And then you get the overflow and it's like, oh, look, the change. And then, but it's not that, right? It is the unbelievable amount of work that is done in the much smaller ways that allows for it. Like, no, there's no such thing as spontaneous movement in the same, like, these things are all undergirded by tons and tons and tons and tons of effort that get sort of missed by the big story when like 400,000 people go out in Montreal for the climate strike in 2019, right? Like, that's like a huge thing. It's like, oh, look how great it was. But that didn't just come out of nowhere, right? That came from years of organizing.
And I know that we're all being crushed right now by the cost of living and everybody's working like six jobs. And so a big barrier, I think, is the idea of like, well, I don't have time to do work for free. But an hour, if everybody in the world gave an hour a month right, to a cause that was building a movement for a better world, I mean, change would happen overnight for real. And so it doesn't need to be, you know, a second job. It can be once a month, once every 2 months, offering to help out with something. And I know a ton of people are already doing this when they volunteer in maybe the local soup kitchen, or maybe they're volunteering with their church. People are volunteering, right? And it's like, pick a cause that maybe is addressing a root issue. I mean, also do those other things. They're great. But if you have the capacity to, you know, up it by 30 minutes a month or an hour a month, you know, pick something that is solving the problem of that soup kitchen needing to be there.
Yeah, 100%. And also just like making those small steps, I think, you know, we referred to it as bricklaying earlier, but like when you're doing that, it's very rewarding. It helps you sleep better at night because it helps you feel as though you're part of the solution to this big existential crisis that we're facing. I think the other thing as well, like in addition to just sort of picking a skill that you have and contributing it, you can also sort of think about one way in which you can add your improvement in like a small way. So that could be anything from like organizing sustainability initiatives in your workplace to maybe if you're already involved in a climate movement and what you want is for there to be more, you know, activities like you want to do a collective mural during the next march. Like you can bring that idea and people are going to be really receptive to it in most cases. And that's just going to make the movement better and more fun for everybody. It's going to bring more people in.
Yeah. A big recurring theme was make your movement fun. Nobody wants to do something that sucks, you guys. Like, and there's so much fun to be had. Have a dance party, have a mural painting party, like Kristen suggested. Wear fun matching outfits, right? Like any way that, like whatever, like think about something that makes you smile and then think about how you can bring that with you to a cause you love. And that was something that I really picked up from the conversations we had. And I love it. I share it with you now.
Amazing. Well, maybe we can leave us on that wonderfully positive note. But before we go, how can folks catch this series?
They can look up the climate organizing hubs, the climate justice organizing hubs, climate organizing shorts. Climate organizing shorts should be the Google term that you use to find the podcast. But you can also go to the climate justice organizing hub, Le Hub. You can go to their website and find it there. But anywhere you find podcasts, you can find climate organizing shorts. I know you said earlier that you wish that you'd thought of this idea, but there are so many practical tips. So if you decide to make your own series, I'm in. Like, I would love to hear more from different people about how to build a movement. It's super fun. You should totally do it yourself.
All right. I mean, I may steal the idea then. I'll follow up. Or if y'all need help organizing part two, maybe we can do a whole collaboration. That'd be fun. You heard it here first, folks. So thank you both so much. This has been Kyla Hewson and Kristen Pugh from the Pullback Podcast, fellow members of the Harbinger, which is the group name for those of us on the Harbinger Network. Thank you both so much. And again, really great work on this and really excited to listen to it.
It's not easy.